to the DTFF podcast. I'm here with two fire friends. We've got Scott.
Hey.
We've got Ash.
Hey.
Tonight, news, I guess. Let's start with some news. Maui, Scott?
Yeah, Maui. It didn't start. When did it start? A few days ago, right? After our last one.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it hit really fast. Big wildfire. I'm in Maui. Currently 93 people have been killed and 2,200 structures destroyed or damaged.
Yeah.
Most of that is in the town of Lahaina, which is like, my wife is actually telling me it's like the traditional, it's like some traditional.
It used to be like the capital.
Yeah. Sorry. That's what I was going to say. Yeah. The capital of Hawaii. Yeah. So. Very old school, lots of old buildings, oldest banyan tree in America or something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Actually, Kevin was just there.
Yeah, that's right. He was chatting about that. I actually saw a photo of it after he shows us a photo of his whole family in front of the tree.
That's right.
And then somebody posted one. I don't know when they posted, but I saw it today. And the tree still stands, but it's like charred, everything's gone.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So obviously, like, Hawaii's in a tropical climate, so they're not used to wildfires. It's usually it's humid enough. Like their humidex is so much higher. Like their relative humidity is way. Like I don't think they hit crossover.
Yeah,
right, usually because exactly. It's like, you know, they're usually like, you know, not 60-80% humidity rate. So it's like, oh, they, you know, I don't know if they have many wildfires there. It's definitely hot there, but it's actually not as hot as it is here. It's like normally it's 27-28 degrees there.
Mm-hmm.
Like. All the time. It's always that hot. And it's usually raining at some point in, you know,
that's right.
2 weeks kind of thing. But I guess they hadn't had rain in a while. Obviously, they're not set up for what, like, we are. They probably don't do fire smarting from everything I've seen there because I go there quite often. They don't do fire smarting on their buildings because they don't really – it's not on their big list, right?
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, I think there was a list of number one dangers for in Maui. They had just done a threat assessment for their area, and it was like
fog attack.
No, it was like tsunami, volcano, stuff that we would never. We don't have a tsunami or a volcano. Yeah, like all these like kind of like stuff that you'd think on a tropical island, and then wildfire was like one of their last things.
Right, at the bottom of the list,
And then of course this happened, but I mean, contributed to it was the hurricane force winds. Mm-hmm. There's a hurricane like several hundred miles away from the islands, but. Obviously, there's lots of wind that gets generated that 80 kilometer, and even what? No, what was it? I forget how fast it was, but it was, you know, quite substantial winds. And we know there's just a little bit of wind that other night when on your fire and what it did. It
changed
just,
stuff so quick.
It changed the direction on that fire. Yeah, came back right on top.
We were like 40 kilometer kind of winds.
Yeah. And this is like probably triple that. I'm
thinking.
So really, like just turbocharged that and just blasted it. Right?
Mm-hmm.
So, and then it hit the wooden frame structures. They're older wood frame structures, so they don't win up quick.
That's right.
Yeah.
You know what? We were talking the other night at practice about it too. And, you know, talking about resources, like all you have is the small resources on that small little island that you can draw from. It's not like here where you can put out a message and now you get roaming task forces from all over the place, you know, Alberta and up from the States. And it's very easy for us to bring resources in. It takes a little bit sometimes, but now the way we model things and they prep everything, people are fairly close by. Whereas there, you can't really ask the big island of Hawaii next to you to ship over a couple of fire engines in a pretty speedy response. You're kind of trapped. Yeah.
And, you know, I don't think they have some fire helicopters, it sounds like, but they don't have any, like, they're not going to have water bombers.
Mm-hmm. And on the winds. The wind.
Yeah, and the winds. Wind's really bad that would ground them, but even if the winds weren't there, like, I don't think they have water bombers. And can they pick up from the ocean? Because the waves are...
Right.
Yeah.
Like on a lake, it's easy because the waves are only ever going to be a foot high.
Mm-hmm.
But I've never seen water bombers picking up from the ocean.
Skim over the ocean.
I can't imagine. Yeah. And actually, someone asked me, and I didn't have the answer, but I'm assuming that you can. Can you pump? Can a fire engine pump salt water?
Sure.
It could if you had to. I don't know.
I've never thought of it.
It would be their go-to because it'd be pretty hard on things for a long run.
Mm-hmm. But then I was like, well, fireboats. I mean, fireboats in the water, they have them.
But what's the maintenance?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, right? So. Like, yeah, can it just a regular engine pump?
A lot of stainless, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Right?
Like, can our engine pump salt water?
It'll go. Just, it's going to cause rust, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm. But that kind of an emergency.
Oh, yeah, you don't need to do it.
Water today, right? But,
yeah. Yeah, but the Maui, they're pretty crazy images coming from all over the place, especially the TikToks now, just like all these personal videos of people fleeing the fire, running into the ocean, and burn patients, right? Going into the ocean.
Yeah.
Like, it's pretty wild.
Mm. Yeah, that's the blessing and the curse of our technology that we have today is, I think, all of these videos that you would see certain video from the news or whatever, but now you're getting all these, like, personal videos are going up, and we talk about, like war, we talk about fire, we talk about all this stuff. Like, there's so much more insight into what's actually happening there. These little snapshot videos, it's just crazy.
Yeah. I think, like, the other thing too, like, they talked about, why didn't their national alert system go out early enough? And, I don't know, like, for us, like, on our
phone, when yours hit off, like, right? Well, it kicked off when we were
pretty scene. Late.
Because we were on scene.
The wildfires and the evacuation order and this and that.
Yeah.
But again, like, that stuff takes a while.
We had got there, and I think we were probably there for a good hour.
It came in when we were driving down.
Okay. So, yeah. So,
with the engine.
Okay. So we were going to have a good half an hour. Yeah. Yeah. It came in because I remember I joked. I'm like, hey, it's telling you there's a wildfire in your area, Todd. You're like, I know. It's like, we're like, the fire's coming over the hill.
Exactly. Yeah, but anyways, our thoughts are with everybody out in Maui. Pretty tragic events.
Absolutely.
Then I guess local news, we're entering another heat wave.
Yeah.
So it's not like our heat dome we had the previous year that lasted for like kind of almost 2 weeks into the high 30s and low 40s. But yeah, this week coming up, starting tomorrow, we're supposed to be reaching about 40 degrees in our area.
Yeah.
For the next couple of days anyways, and then high 30s. For our area, so that's going to be challenging for us if we have any sort of event.
Yeah,
yeah. So, yeah, we got to plan accordingly to that and rehab. Boot water.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Pocket water.
Water. Yeah. Water. Yeah. Yeah. Hydrate. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Luckily, last year we didn't have a structure fire.
Any major events.
Yeah. In that. But man, you get a structure fire in that heat wave now. It's pretty hard to cool off and start taking care of yourself.
But. Swapping guys out quick.
Yeah.
It's mutually wrong.
Doffing that gear mutually immediately.
Yeah. Mutually, not even because you're going to be overwhelmed by the fire. It's just you're overwhelmed by the heat.
Absolutely. Yeah. Mm-hmm. There's actually, I always keep a little photo of it somewhere here about the heat wave. We didn't talk about heat stroke and heat exhaustion. Where is it? Somewhere. I swear it's in here. It's supposed to be. Bear with me.
No. Just some guy sweating. Exactly. Just Todd sweating in his underwear. Look at this. His last heat wave. Great. Great picture.
Hang on. Give me a minute. You guys talk.
Where do we go from there after that, right?
I don't know.
Should we move on?
We can move on.
I think it's part of the heat wave. We're actually on to training. Are we done? Are we done with the news?
Yes, we are.
Yeah. Kind of the point of the training we've been doing the last 2 weeks. Oh, here we go.
Well, boom. Found it. So the reason why I want to talk about this is because we bring it up anytime we have our safety briefings for the heat wave stuff. So there's a lot of common misconceptions and mix-ups between heat exhaustion and heat stroke. So heat exhaustion, your kind of key signs and symptoms, nausea, fatigue, dizziness, weakness, rapid pulse, and the treatment for that is seek shade, drink some cool fluids, and rest, right? Heat stroke, seizures, agitation, confusion, slurred speech, loss of consciousness. And the number one treatment for heat stroke is cold water immersion, right? So very, very... very, very common practice for that. And the biggest thing everybody always freaks out about, they think, oh, well, they're not sweating anymore. Like, that's not an indicator if you're sweating or not sweating for it. So it's the confusion and agitation and the loss of consciousness. Those are the big ones.
So like cold water immersion, like when you dump a tender tank and put the guy in it, could that be a thing? As long as you keep your head above the water, obviously.
Yeah, basically rapid cooling, right? So if you have something that's cold that you can pour over the individual, or just something to rapidly cool that body.
Right.
ice. Yeah. I mean, if you have a cooler full of ice and, yep. and water, make it cold, right? For the tree.
Yeah.
So we got to start cooling that core very quickly. Yep. So yeah. Anyways, lots of little things on there, especially a lot of the mountain medic stuff, is really good for this. Like this one's off of raw medicine. It's a great little slide. Anyways, training.
We can post that up.
Yeah, we will. Yeah, we'll post that up. We'll show everybody what I'm talking about. So. Training coming up. I guess one that you guys just did, Scott.
Yeah, so kind of knowing what the weather's going to be like in the next few weeks, decided that we're going to do, and we haven't done it for a while, decided we're going to do some river rescue, some water rescue. We unfortunately missed, we should try to do it in June, just because that's when we're hitting the high water. Mm-hmm. You know, and that's really when the more technical rescues happen. But it's also, it was good the other day because, you know, we did it, you know, I was kind of joking, the swift water wasn't very swift.
No.
But, you know, it still had some depth and, you know, people are still tubing right now down the river because it's going to be hot. So people are going to be floating down our river.
Yeah.
You know, our river is not, it's not whitewater, you know, class four. It's safe but dangerous at the same time because mm-hmm. I mean, we have these weird, like logs and debris piles and like so many strainers. People are going down in their floaties. It's not like it's not a well-maintained like tourist attraction. Like mm-hmm. there's one in Penticton above us.
Yeah. Yeah.
That is like literally a straight shot flume. you can park on one net. Like today we were driving through and I look up and you can see like 500 people on the freaking river floating.
But even on that, like if they still get some drownings up there,
yeah.
People will tie their tubes together. And then they wrap around the bridge abutment, mm-hmm. and then they end up getting entrapped.
Yeah.
And that's with our river. Like, it's there's shallow areas, but you start tying together, mixing some booze with that. It doesn't take much water,
for sure.
But if anything over a few feet, you're gonna be pinned, right? So,
yeah.
So you know, it wasn't the swiftest water. So it wasn't like technically hard to do, but it was a good refresher and also a good training aid for the newest people. Mm-hmm. So we brought Matt out, who's he's definitely probably our most trained water technician. He's also our ropes technician. He does courses all over Canada, does all these crazy courses. So he was taking the lead and then I was kind of helping him with it. We went over basic throw bags, some whistle stuff. You know, like one, two blasts, three blasts, that kind of stuff. Just the different options on that. We did a little bit of tethered swimming. So, you know, we went down the list of like, hey, what's the safest thing to do? And it's always, you know, what's the safest thing? And right away, someone's like, ah, throw a rope. Well, no, what's even safer than that? Oh, right. Yeah. Call. Yeah. Just use your voice. Because sometimes they just need encouragement. Hey, come to the shore, come to the shore. So they, you know, or maybe you yell at them and they're like, what are you doing? Like, I'm just floating in the river. Maybe they're not even in any distress. You're like, okay. So, your voice first and then you go for the reach. So, mm-hmm. you know, if you can't bring them over, you reach for something like a stick or a pike pole or something. Yeah. And then you throw the rope, just cause it's a little bit more technical to get it out there properly. So that's a big thing that we're training on is the throwback. Cause that, you know, it's probably our number one tool out of everything. So, you know, throw bags next, and then finally, there's the boat, and there's a go, but we don't have a boat. We don't have a boat. So we sent a swimmer out, and we did tethered swimming and non-tethered swimming actually. Mm-hmm. So tethered swimming, obviously, we tie a rope to the guy, he swims out, grabs a patient, and then gives a signal and gets pulled back in. Yeah. The other one is untethered. So a strong swimmer goes like maybe they see the person floating down or the person stuck on a log or what to go under. Okay, we don't have time. Or maybe we don't want to tether the person because as soon as you get a tether on, it's like it's dragging you down.
You got some drag, yeah.
You got drag. And then one of the areas we were kind of playing in at the end of the night, we were working in, was there was this massive tree down. And it's basically made kind of like a little dam upstream and lots of cool little water features around it, like rapids. So if I was just trying to swim out there tethered, I'm going to get hung up in the tree, hung up on the rocks, it would be... So, for that, we just actually went downstream a little bit and we found like the different, options, like the downstream Vs, upstream Vs, when we can swim into them, where can you swim and get behind in the eddies, then keep swimming over and then finally get over the tree and using that tree, cause now the tree's creating a, like that dam. So there's lots of, lots of like kind of laminar quiet space behind that tree, so we could just swim right up to it and climb up the tree, get like pretty much in a perfect position. So, so that's kind of what we did all night. Had a few of us that could, that I was gonna say a few of us that could swim. A few of us that are trained swimmers, so we were in the water and the guys were throwing throw bags to us. Everybody did really well. But at the beginning it was fun, it's always the same, like bags are flying everywhere and people are missing.
Yeah.
But then by the end of the night, it's like people are.
I got
hit with like four in the face. Because I pretend to be like a dead guy floating down. And all I see is bags like boom. It's like trying to, like they're hitting me in the head. Like, whoa, whoa, whoa.
Yeah. So. Well, I find it's always a little tip too. Like everybody tries to throw a dry rope bag right away. Mm-hmm. But if you can just dip it in that water, get that little bit of water weight with you, and then and throw it. It
goes a long way.
Yeah. And then, of course, if you miss that throw, now you're spooling it back in, and then it's a different style.
Yeah, so we did that a bunch. We did the like the straight throw bag and the redeploy, and the rethrow.
Yeah, I think it went really, really well. It was really good for some of our newer recruits and newer members now, because we haven't hosted a swiftwater course for a year or so, 2 years. So there's a few people that haven't really seen much up close and personal when it comes to swiftwater rescue. And like we started chatting about on Thursday night, the stuff that happens on the shore is way more complex, if you will, than what actually happens there. Like, I mean, in our river specifically, because there's not a ton of like super challenging things for people that are trained to be in there. There are some challenging aspects to the river, but when it comes to a rescue, I mean, it's fairly safe. But when you start looking at like the action that happens on the shore, that's where your, you know, throw bags are, that's where your upstream, your downstream containment, that's where if you have to set up a rope system, that's where all of that stuff is coming into play, which is sweet the way that this is tied in from the two different classes there. So one is out on the river, and it was very basic. Like, it's just a super quick awareness, just so, hey, like, I can be useful even if I don't have training here. And then the people over on the rope side probably learn the majority of that setup, just not in the water, which is great.
Well, and there's times where, you know, you had to take people off the little islands as well. Like,
yeah, that's our number one thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, because it may not be like that classic water rescue, but now they're safe on an island, so now we need to make it safe to get back. Yeah. So then you start doing your tension diagonals and stuff, right?
Yeah, like, you know, we always train for the floater guy going by, but like Matt was saying, like, if by the time we get paged out, we go down to where the guy was last seen, well, he's now
2 kilometers
down the other way, right? Yeah. Or he's more likely to tangle up in a tree.
Yeah.
And that's really what our bread and butter is getting them getting hung up in these trees or these root balls. Mm-hmm. I think we've rescued multiple people off islands. That's been our number one thing. Because like, we have these little islands upstream that are, you know, not Maui-sized islands. They're like little tiny little, 20 by 60 feet across kind of deal. Like, they're not very big.
Full of poison ivy.
Yeah, full of poison ivy and mosquitoes.
Yeah.
Weird stuff like that. And typically the person gets themselves there and they just don't want to get back in the river, because they probably could get back in the river if they go down, if they walk downstream a little bit, they probably get back in the river and be okay. But now they're
so spooked.
They're scared. So we figured it out for them. That's kind of our bread and butter. I think the only other, before we ever had swift water, I was the only rescue guy for a while, and the guy rescued 3 people off a root ball. It's like floating root ball. His family of 3 was like on this floating root ball in the middle of the river. Mm-hmm. So that was it. And it was like, I think I did like 2 strokes, got there, pulled the kid off. They pulled me back, let him go. 2 strokes, grabbed the mom back. 2 strokes. Like, it was like, it wasn't like a very complex rescue. Yeah. I just, you know, very basic swim.
It's providing some flotation for them as you have them.
Yeah.
I think it was far enough. They were actually, the guys were throwing me the same PFD back every time I'd swim across. I'd give them PFD, put them in it, and then I'd get pulled back across. I was like just the ferry guy, right? So, and if that's all we ever get, that's fine.
Yeah, we have had, so we have these drop structures.
Yeah, right.
And we have had at least one rescue off of that. He's like a cheap Canadian entire dinghy, and they washed through it, but then it was getting that backwash, and they were just kind of stuck there. And I think it was like slowly losing air, and like the most like anti-dramatic event, because you get there and they're literally just floating in the midst of like pretty fast moving water, but where they're stuck, they're pretty good. And if they're kind of through the bad part already, so if they would just wash out, they would probably just wash out.
But if they were to wash out, because the problem with those drop structures is they literally drop. They do like that. They make the worst case scenario of a rapid. Yeah. They drop into a void space and then they recycle.
So do you want to, for people that don't know what a drop structure is, do you want to describe it?
Yeah, it's basically, so the river, it's, some people call it a low head dam too. It's not fully a low head dam, but basically our river, as it goes down over the years, like they've made these rivers, our river in particular, the more of a channel. Because it used to be a very slow moving river. I'm not sure why they did it the way they did it, but they made it into basically a chute. And it loses height as it goes down, right? So to make that happen, they made these drop structures. And I think it was like 18 drop structures in our area. So every few kilometers, there's a drop structure. And what it is basically this cement bridge. And it's got, I'm going to say like 6 or 7 ports in it where the water goes through and it drops it down this into this like kind of cauldron of water. Then it goes over like a little bit of low head dam and then it flushes out. And in the middle, there's a kind of this flush point at Ashton where you can get flushed out. But everywhere else, when you go over, it's like you go over the tongue of water and it drops you and they call it a drowning machine. You get dropped into this machine. You get launched right to the bottom of the river and then you get sucked back up. If you're lucky,
and then you get
dumped back in,
back into it,
yeah, and you just keeps doing this over, like keeps flipping over and over like again,
washing
like
washing machine, yeah,
yeah. And if you don't swim out when you're at the bottom, you're just gonna keep getting cycled. So, it is actually a very dangerous part of it. That's that, and the strainers are two most dangerous things in our river. Drop structures, they're like well signed, like there's like death symbols, and don't go there. There's a chain link fence, like don't go past here. You know, you'll be dead. I remember there was always skull and crossbones when we were young. Everyone would steal the signs off the bridge. Like, oh, that's a sweet sign.
In your bedroom.
Yeah, I think I might have had one in my first apartment when I was growing up. It's like the drowning machine, like over the toilet. This symbol of a guy getting sucked down this thing and it's like, it looked like a toilet. So, but it was these signs, right? It's like, you know, everywhere. And people that are from here know better, but some people are just like, oh, that's a cool rapid. I'm going to go through that on my dinghy. Bloop.
Yeah.
Haven't had a death in there in a while. Mm-hmm. I remember when I was growing up, we had three of my classmates or two of my classmates died when I was younger. So it does happen, and going through the dinghy is super dangerous. So that one we actually went to. It looked like it was the thing was just kind of floating there, but I think if they would have jumped out to swim, there was
a potential. That would have been a problem.
Yeah. Could we have pulled them out and kind of flushed them down? Yeah. But once you make contact with them, the rule of so far is you're
responsible now.
Yeah. So now if we're just going to push you guys with the pike pull out so you flush out, and then next thing they flip over and they drown. We're like, So we actually sent two swimmers out. They swam up. They swam, got on the lower dam, kind of shimmy across the lower dam, and then swam them and grabbed them. And then they floated down to them, and then we pulled them back in. So it works really well. It's still technical rescues. Like we do, if someone gets really pinned on one of those trees, you can't just walk out there. You gotta figure out how to lower the swimmer down, pick them off and pull them back up. It's actually fairly complicated.
You gotta understand what the water is doing and where the safe spots are in the water. Right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So, we still have, I think we have 10 techs still, but yeah, just getting out there on the river and being able to see, even the other day, it was a good refresher for me because I haven't taken a tech course in a while, because once I became an officer, I was more like shore-based guy. Mm-hmm. But I'm like, maybe I'll take the tech course again next year. Just even the other day with us swimming those little ports that Matt got me to swim. It's like just understanding where the points are, where you can swim, where you shouldn't swim, and where you can like, you have to give her and then you can stop. And then the kind of river helps you. And knowing all that kind of stuff is it's important. Yeah. Yeah, and then as Ash was saying, so that was one half of the practice, and the other half of the crew was doing rope rescue. And ropes and swift water are going hand in hand, because like you're saying, on the shore, basically the most complicated thing is ropes stuff, and that's the shore-based rescue stuff. It's a lot like a fire. Like, you're going to structure fire. There's only one guy running the nozzle. usually. Like, maybe there may be a big fire, maybe there's a few guys running also. But if you're going an interior attack, only one person in the whole fire is actually doing a firefighting task, like, or like a firefighting thing. Like, they're spraying the fire with a nozzle. Everyone else is, like, the backup guy is not spraying the fire. The, you know, the officer is not spraying the fire. No one else is spraying the fire except for one guy. Yeah. So he's getting all the cool glory, the cool GoPro footage, but he's got a support staff of 20 making his job happen.
Yeah.
So same thing as with the Swiftwater guy. If he's going out to, if the swimmer's going out to rescue somebody, there is a support staff of 20 people.
Yeah.
You know, downstream, upstream, officers, medics, everybody's. And then if we're going to do a rope system, that complicates things, because now we got to like start figuring out tension diagonals, like how are we going to pull upstream and right angles, and you know, don't have a sagging line because now the guy's going to get stuck, and if he gets stuck, he's going to have to blow out, and then we have the downstream guy, downstream swimmer, and all.
So maybe explain that, because for non-swimmers, being able to blow out of your gear.
Yeah, so
well, maybe the tension diagonal.
Yeah, so tension diagonal is basically you're making a zip line across the river.
Yeah.
So when you make a zip line, you want to make it on an angle, like a 45-degree angle, in such a way that when you hook up your, like, because you have this kind of strap attached to your PFD, because when you're in your life jacket, you don't want to tie a rope. That's one of the absolutes. Never tie a rope to yourself, like that you can't get out of with swift water, because again, you get pinned. And cutting yourself out of things is really hard. Like, we have to do that in the training. You have to, like, they tie you. Well, you remember, they tie you to a rope, and they drop you in the river, and the next thing you're like, ah! And it's like the most benign current, and you're upside down.
I had to cut myself out in like 8 inches of water.
Yeah, and it's still like tough.
I had a throw bag wrap around my finger, and I was just stuck. I couldn't rotate. I couldn't pull myself up. I was pinned against the rocks. Yeah. And I tried everything. I was like, fuck, I actually had to give my life and get cut.
Oh.
Yeah.
So, like, it's a hard thing to do. So that's why we don't ever want to get in that situation if we can help it. So our PFDs, our flotation devices, have a pull cord. So the pin strap is tied to the wherever we're tied to. And then when you pull that rip cord, it pulls out, and then that ring's left hanging, and you float away. Yeah. So you're not tethered anymore. So now you got to save yourself. But you're not also tethered to a rock anymore. Like, you slammed into this rock. So so that's kind of what we use for the tension diagonal. We use that strap. We clip ourselves into the diagonal we've made, and we'll float across the shore. We'll get the
picture. You're using the stream of the river to push you down that
angle. Ferry angle pulls you across, right? And then we set up a second one that's aimed back to the shore, back to the opposite side. So you grab your patient and sail back over, and you're basically, and it is, you're like, you're sailing. It's really cool when you're on there. And you can use a pulley system if you want, or a carabiner, just is fine, because there's enough force from the river.
Yeah.
You do have to send people over first, so that's always a tough one. You have to, like, okay, who are we sending over first?
Get a strong swimmer over, swim the line across, anchor it.
Or you can, one option I really like now is what we do is we send a good swimmer over. He gets there, because, you know, most of it's in our river, it's probably, you know, a 50-foot throw, maybe 20, 30-foot throw. So they swim over, they break off a branch, and then they wait, and they kind of wade in the water a little bit. And then the best throw bagger, he hucks that throw bag as far as he can to the guy. So he never actually swam over tethered. Mm-hmm. And then they pull the line across. Because we've done it both ways. And I find, like, sometimes the tether swimmer, like,
it's a lot of drag.
Like, even our best swimmer, he's getting drugged, and then he's downstream, and he's getting flushed out.
Yeah.
So it's a challenge. So there's other way I actually prefer it. I prefer sending a pretty strong swimmer over, and then he breaks up a branch and waits there, and it's nice. The line is
nice.
Like, if you miss it, right? And then they tie off, and then they set up the diagonal. So then that diagonal is actually very easy. It's basically a Z-rig. Both upstream and downstream, you just make a Z-rig. So, and that's really where our ropes training overlaps is. This is Z-rig. We learn is the same thing we learn on rescue, on rope rescue. So it's a 3-to-1, basic 3-to-1. Gives you the mechanical advantage, and the only difference is you're not, rather than pulling a patient up, you're just trying to basically pull the tree on the opposite shore out of the ground. It's not going to happen, hopefully. And then once it's tight, that's your zip line.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the guys, the second crew trained ropes all night. And they actually just trained on kind of flat land. Just went over the different systems. Much like you, we have a redundant system. So they're both the same setup. We used to do like, this is a haul line. This is a safety line. This is this and this. It was very complicated. Guys are like, what line am I on? I don't know. Remember. Now it's just basically both are haul, both are safety. If one fails, the other one's right there. Yeah. It's supported.
Totally redundant.
We're using, you guys are using what?
We're using the MPDs.
Yeah, and then we're using the Maestros. Basically the exact same thing. And it's a redundant system, and it just backs each other up.
Yeah.
And we do low angle rescue. We don't do high angle stuff right now, but low angle rescue is still pretty steep. It's like anywhere you can't really walk, right?
Yeah.
And like I said, it does translate over to that water rescue. So that's one thing we've been kind of talking to our guys about, like, hey, training will always translate over. Like, we could be training swiftwater one day, but meanwhile, something else translates right over to it. So
that's right.
So training always translates over to each other, and that's what we do it. Like, there's not many things in the fire service that don't, at least some way, shape, or form, translate to the other training we've done.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, so you guys are just doing all just flat-based in the hall setups. And
yeah, the guys are actually pulling a truck to show how much strength they can use, like two or three guys, they can pull a tow a vehicle.
Yeah. Nice. What we did actually, so we had a pretty good MVI the other week. So we were just breaking down a little bit, kind of debriefing of the MVI on the setup of kind of basic tool requirements for our bread and butter MVIs, if you will. Because a lot of times that we find in the training environment, we'll say, okay, well, this is going to be our scenario, or if we're just doing a step-by-step training evolution, we get, okay, pull out the tarp, set up the tool that you need for this type of an event, and next thing you know, you turn around and the whole friggin' truck is unloaded on the tarp, right? So you got all of our cribbing and all of our hydraulics, all of our hand tools, and there's a lot of stuff. So we're trying to tweak it a little bit, so no, just the minimum standard of what we want on our single two-vehicle MVA that isn't rolled on the side or not down an embankment or something. So let's just say like a two-vehicle T-bone, for example. We want an extinguisher out or some sort of form of suppression line. We're going to want minimum wheel chocks. Mm-hmm. Some step cribs are really good. Your cutters and spreaders and pump. Your hand tools, a Halligan, windshield saw. Some soft protection for the patient, and then some like cordless sawzalls, things like that. Pretty much that minimum will get you everything you need, whatever you're doing. Your RAM as well. But we don't need the specialty items.
The X-Pouch.
Yes. Yeah. And prime example, so in the X-Pouch or your tool bag or whatever you have with your department, which the X-Pouch works fabulous.
Yeah.
Well, throw that out in a minute here, probably. Mm-hmm. You got to think of what you're doing. So everybody was asking, like, well, what about, why are we only bringing the step chocks up? What about the rest of the cribbing? If I have two vehicles on all four wheels and it's fairly stable as it is, we just need some minimum stabilization. We don't need to get all crazy. I don't need to be building boxes and stuff like that. So do your own windshield survey in your truck as you're coming up. We're still going to get kind of the marching orders and the extrication plan, possibly from the IC, or the IC may say, hey, this is what we got. Okay, Scott, you're the guy from this truck. Go ahead and go get your extrication plan. But while that's happening, the guy's going to be pulling out the minimum stuff. If you see a vehicle on the side, guess what you're going to be pulling out? I'm going to be pulling out some struts now.
Yep.
Right? So we need the guys to think independently on what they want, but we also need a minimum standard. Mm-hmm. So yeah, that was the biggest push that we were working on. Just that minimum standard, what you want out for what your task at hand is going to be doing. Then we did some patient removal, C-spine stuff. Based on our last MVA, it was a bit of a cluster. There's a lot of other departments involved. It was a scene with forestry. And the information passed right away early on was no extrication required. And that came to the ambulance, that came to the fire department. When we got there, everybody's kind of in that mindset. It's like, oh, we don't really need much. There's off-duty medic there working the patient. We did the handover. I started assessing the patient and then started looking at, hey, no, now we got to get this person out. And my first go-to was that got the spine board in beside them on the stretcher, started getting guys in. I started looking at the patient and it's like, no, this is not going to work. We need the door removed and the B post gone at minimum. The reason for that is pelvic injuries, chest injuries. We don't want to manipulate that patient too much. We don't want to be doing a lot of pushing and pulling and twisting. So ideally, your patient extrication vertical is the safest and less impactful for the patient, right? So roof flap, roof removal, we can do that. This particular one, we could just slide the board under them and pivot and lay them down and get them out, which we did do. However, we needed that B-post gone. The placement of the seat and where that B-post was in this particular vehicle, it was covering half of the patient's kind of left side and hip area. So it was going to make it very difficult to get that board in. And the power had already been cut prior to our arrival. And it was a power seat, so we couldn't slide it back. She was very close to the steering column and the dash. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of difficulties there. And then, of course, speed. We need things done fairly quickly.
The power cut, or was it just removed?
I believe it was cut, but yeah, prior to our arrival. I don't know for sure, but that was the information we were told. And because I was the medic in charge on that event, so I don't know all the things that took place exactly with the extrication, but yeah, like we really just enforce, like, look, like as a fire department, we need to really pitch the idea to the medic, say, hey, we are set up for a roof removal, a door removal, a post removal, whatever. We can have it done in this amount of time frame. What do you need done based off on that patient's injuries, right? Mm-hmm. And I always say, like, the patient's injuries are going to dictate our response. Mm-hmm. So that car's already fucked. No, we need to be in the mindset of getting that stuff out quickly and making it easier for the patient and the medics. So by getting our stuff set up quickly every time and then getting in there and getting that stuff removed, even if you're not necessarily firing things up and ready to go, as long as you're in that mindset of getting, hey, this is our plan. As soon as we get the, yeah, that's a good idea, we're ready to go. Like you can start peeling, peeking and ripping and stripping or whatever term you want to use, looking for those airbags and stuff and peeling that plastic off. It needs to be done fairly quickly.
Yeah, we were, we were talking about the cutting the B pillar out. It's like when it's like maybe don't do it all the time, but always be ready to do it.
Yeah.
Like our extrication instructors were just like, just ask paramedics, hey, does this have to happen in the next 5 minutes?
Yeah.
No. Okay. Well, it takes us 5 minutes to take a roof off. We can take a roof off, or at bare minimum, we'll take that B pillar out and the door off. It's almost like people feel it's like too much trouble or like, and I think the paramedics to this day still think, oh, I don't want to trouble the fire guys to do it. Well, first of all, we have a $1 million truck that rarely ever gets used for this stuff. We want to cut things up.
Yeah.
And like you said, the car's already destroyed. Cutting a B-pillar out is really nothing. It's really easy to do. And cutting a door off is again, that's like bread and butter day one extrication stuff.
Easy stuff.
Yeah. So, like, we do it with little kids. You know, we have, like, little fire training things. We hold the door for the kid, and he cuts the door apart. Like, we can do it. It's easy. It doesn't take any – our tools are made for this. Like, I'm a big fan of taking the door off. Even to this day, a lot of our guys are still like, oh, we don't really need to take the door off. We can get a work around it. We'll just rip on it until it bends. Like, no, we can just cut it off.
Yeah.
Like, it's the car is gone. Like,
and I think
– there's no saving the car.
I think, as this is my opinion of it, like, I think where a lot of this communication is happening and the misinformation and the lack of communication between the two agencies is because over the years, our C-spine rules have really changed. Right. Back in the day, it was, man, you're in there, you're holding the head, the collar's coming in, you're putting a board under them, the full C-spine, you're taping the head down, the whole works, you're strapping the legs together, you're putting a pelvic binder on, and away you go. But now, it's really changed based on age, mechanism, injuries, things like that. So we have a lot more discretion of when to put a collar on and when not to.
Right.
And that may even be, okay, we're putting a collar on, but then, hey, can you stand and pivot with our assistance even though they have a hard collar on? Mm-hmm. And a lot of people can't grasp that idea because it seems weird, right?
Right.
Because back in the day, you'd hold C-spine like, oh, you moved your pinky finger, you failed. You know, people were still anal.
Literally failed my One of my EMR courses, it was like someone moved their my partner moved the head of the patient like a millimeter.
Yeah.
Oh, your partner lost control of the head of him. What?
Yeah. So
you're watching your partner.
There's a lot of changes now with the C-spine rules, and I think now we just need that communication on scene. Like you said, as a fire service, talk to the medics, be like, hey, how much time do you need? This is how long it's going to take for us to get this removed. We're already set up and ready to go.
Yeah. And our guys have to know that too.
Yes.
Everybody has to know, like, hey, no, it's not like, we don't really need to remove it. Like, why we're here? Like, cut our thing off.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. I love it. Bring the tools out. Like, just bring the tools out. Start cutting things. Like, maybe I'll start cutting things. Like, cut it, you know, with a plan, of course. But
Yeah. And I mean, it's kind of the nature of the beast of what we're in now. We have a lot of new medics working straight out of school. A lot of them aren't fully PCP. Yeah. They're EMRs. I work with amazing EMRs and amazing PCPs. And I also work with duds, you know, so it is what it is. Like, it's the nature of the beast. It's like, we've got certain individuals in every service that, you know, aren't as quick or as experienced to make that call when you need it. Right. So by having that communication and saying to these guys, hey, this is what we can do. They may not have an idea yet. They might be a very green individual and only done the training for the AutoX and patient removal stuff and then never actually done a serious call yet.
Yeah.
So we're going to run into those things. So that's why we need to communicate with them, say, hey, this is what we can do. What do you need us to do now? Like, just get that conversation started.
Yeah. There was times you turned into a gong show and you're trying to slide them on the board and move their butt and their pillars in the way. Just cut the pillar out.
Yeah. Get out of the way. Yeah. Biggest thing is patient-focused care, right? Do what's right for the patient. Least amount of harm, least amount of movement, get them out.
Yeah. So while we're just chatting there, my brain starts to think, and I don't know if this would work. Well, I know in theory it would work, but I don't know if it'll backfeed enough. So like Todd was saying there, they got the info that the wires were cut. And that's, I mean, for the longest time, that was our thing.
Cut the wires.
Just in there and cut them, right?
Yeah.
So you can't shift the vehicle if it's an automatic. Most times you can't shift it, which, like, we don't care, but the tow guy does. Yeah. But the big thing is you can't move that seat.
Yeah.
So in the auto industry, when you change out the battery, they make an adapter that you can plug into the 12-volt outlet, and you power off a little small battery. I wonder, because it in turn powers the entire car. So you can't start it, which you don't want to do that. But I'm wondering if, hey, you had this little jump kit and you could plug into the outlet.
Right.
Would that feed back through everything? And I know it would, but the 12-volt outlet generally has a pretty low, a low blow fuse. Like, it's not designed to, like, really hammer out the power.
Right.
But I wonder if you're back feeding through, if it would be enough to power up the seats.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I mean, I think the biggest concern people always have is they go, if you re-energize something, what about airbags, blah, blah, blah.
For sure.
But, I mean, for this specific vehicle, every airbag was deployed.
Yeah.
Frontal airbags, side airbags, like the knee ones, everything was deployed.
Yeah.
So there was no concern with airbags. Everything was already popped. And, yeah, by having that power back up, it would have made life a little bit easier, for sure.
Right.
Yeah.
Getting that person out.
Well, and we've gotten away from cutting now. We use a Modus battery disconnector. So,
that's right.
You know, we pop the battery or we use a wrench. Like, obviously, we didn't have the Modus thing, but we use something that just, you know, just pop the battery. You have the one cable hanging there. If we have to, we can always reconnect it.
Yeah.
And just watch what we're doing now. Just keep your head clear of the old airbags, and we can reconnect it for, you know, a few seconds.
Just reach in.
Yeah.
Buzz that seat back, right?
Yeah.
Because again, like, you know, patient care. If you can go and move that seat back and then lay it down,
yeah,
it's going to be the best outcome for the patient potentially. So,
and I think again that comes down to the communication between the two agencies. Like, you know, a lot of times I find some MBAs we're focused on, you know, we do the minimum stuff we need to do, and then our next focus is securing the power source for that vehicle. So we go and start doing the disconnects. But before that happens, we need to have that conversation with that extrication plan of, hey, have we already done this?
Coming out?
Have we refined everything? Yeah. What are we doing?
Although I think in our instructors, when we got taught it, literally battery disconnect was up there with, like,
You chalk the wheels.
You chalk the wheels, disconnect the battery. Like, it wasn't And then I think even before he made patient contact, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, verbal, so, but not.
Yeah, theirs is very like, you know, like disconnect the battery, like, but always disconnect it. Don't cut it. So yeah, just, yeah, just take it off and whatever. Like,
but I think also like you need some common sense into it. Like, like I know it's high up on the list to get done right away, but also like, what's, is there fire concerns? Is there other airbag concerns? Is there spark concerns? Is there like all these things that we look at and automatically do our own assessments where it may not be that pertinent right away. I mean, the downside to this particular MVA is for the ambulance. I mean, it took us a long time to get there. It took us like 35 minutes to get there. We were coming from way out of town. Right. So there was this massive delay and all these other things that were happening before we got on scene to actually dictate what the response plan for that patient was going to be. So that was the challenging one for that particular event, but yeah. I like that idea that you said. That's
yeah,
idea.
Should try it out.
Yeah, let's try it.
So X-Pouch, which we haven't shown, it's actually at our hall right now when we're at Todd's hall. So X-Pouch is a new thing from Modus. It's based on the idea that we kind of took from our instructors, which was, what do they call it? The tool belt of destiny.
Yeah.
That's a joke. So it's this, you know, they just have a, it's like a carpenter's apron kind of deal.
Yeah.
And has all the kind of the small little hand tools in it. And they just, you know, one guy carries it and it could be the captain. Usually if I'm the captain in the front seat, I'll put it on. But it could be a person in the back seat. It could just kind of be the first person who remembers to grab it. The last few, I've been kind of the first one in the door. So as the truck or the driver's coming, I'm putting on the tool belt. So the new Modus one's cool because it's got a, and we've kind of helped design it through some advice from us because, you know, little deeper pockets than the pocket organizer because that's what it was based
that's
on.
That's what we were using.
Yeah, we were using that. We kind of hobbled together. We got someone to sew a seatbelt strap on for us. It was kind of top heavy. It wasn't really working very well. It was working, but not super well.
Yeah, great idea, but
yeah. So then when Paul came and saw it, he's like, "Oh, this is awesome!" So he made deeper pockets, so it fits everything great, nicely balanced. So it doesn't like nothing spills out now. Bigger pocket head across it. It's all reflective, which he's going to actually change to probably more like the Mode 2 one will be more Velcro, so we can stick flashes to it. Or you can also put some reflective on it if you want, because it is a little bit too much reflective, I think. And then it's got the really cool addition is that leg strap.
Yes.
So that right away, as soon as I strap it on my leg, it's like secure, it doesn't move, nothing falls out. You can kneel, stand, turn around, like all stuff, nothing falls out. And you just hand the tools to people. And, and as soon as you're done with it, you don't let them like put it down in the dirt. Give me that back. Put it back in your tool belt.
Yeah, because that's the famous move. They finish and they set it on the roof of the hood.
Like, oh, we're the bar
going. And that's the end of it.
Yeah. So it's a great set of it's a great system to hand those tools to people, get them to do those peel and peaks or the battery disconnect. So it's kind of small, small tasks.
Yeah, and actually that leg strap idea that came from one of our attack medic pouches, kind of for the rescue task force ideas, right?
Yeah.
Mostly because if you are in a kneeling or squatting position, it just holds everything in place very nicely. Which we have a video of you struggling quitting.
When this was all going down, the floor of our bay had packs and pouches all blown apart, and you know it was pretty sweet. I forgot who came in. One of our firefighters walks in, and they're like, "What the hell's going on? We're gonna take this from this and this from this, and we're gonna mesh this and this and that." Like, however many weeks later, we get a photo from Paul, and he's like, "Yeah, check it out." We're like, "Oh, sweet!" So, like, works really well. We're really stoked to have it.
I do like the Cobra
part of our kit.
I think the Cobra buckles are the way to go. Yeah. We have right now that it's kind of the plastic hard buckles. Again, I was, you know, jokes. I was actually struggling the other day trying to put it on my hip.
Yeah,
and I realized I know why I'm struggling because I'm left-handed, and this bag is probably made for a right-handed person. The way the straps are, if it was a right-handed person, I could see the strap.
Oh yeah,
right.
So with me, I'm like I'm reaching across trying to
find it blind.
Yeah. So I'm doing it blind because it's backwards to me.
Yeah.
So if it was the other way around, like if I'm carrying it on my right hip, which maybe I could do because it doesn't really matter. I'm not the one.
Yeah, the pouch is ambidextrous.
Yeah, I'm not the one using the tool. It's not like I'm a gunslinger. Like I have to draw quick. It's like I just have to pull a tool up. Like, here you go. So maybe I should start trying to hang it off my right hip. I bet that would go a lot quicker.
Yeah.
But yeah, that we'll have to get a
little video. Yeah, a quick demo of that. Yeah,
because that X-Pouch is pretty awesome.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it holds a snagger, seatbelt cutter, battery disconnector, and like little
pry bar.
Called pry bars and
yeah.
cutters and stuff like that. Yeah.
Yeah, we still have the old wire snips. Because that comes to hand when you're doing your peel and peek. And
well, even the other day, we had a car, we had a truck rammed into a wall, and the whole battery is like shoved into the like firewall.
Yeah.
Like, mm-hmm. I'm trying to like get in there with the wrench, like, snip.
Yeah.
just snip
yeah, there's like, still, there's definitely still a time where
yeah.
you just have to cut it.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Anyways, yeah, I guess just to kind of wrap that up is, yeah, keep it simple, right? Start
yeah.
simple, but then work to complex. Same as anything. Same as fire ground tactics, right?
Yeah,
it's exactly the same procedures. Like your fire ground tactics are simple to complex. Mm. Extrication simple to complex. Rescues same.
It's got like writ.
I was just gonna say yeah. that. It's writ, like people, building that writ job, yeah. right?
People bring it. Oh, I need all this stuff for writ. Or you can start with this. We yeah. might need a, we might need the entire rescue truck eventually, but let's yeah. start with this.
Yeah,
yeah, mm-hmm. yeah. Anything else to add, guys?
No.
Okay. Let's move into some shout outs then. Let's
Modus.
Yeah, let's jump into Modus.
X-Boat.
Yeah,
X-Boat. Not sure if you've heard about the X-Boat.
It's amazing. Big.
We're actually, we'll do a video on it. This is yeah. the first version. I think there's going to be a couple other versions mm-hmm. by the end of it. We also are going to do a video on the quick stretch, whatever they, whatever yeah. we're calling it, whatever Paul's going to call that thing. Mm-hmm. Paul and Luke, I don't know what they're going to call it, but
yeah,
we kind of throw ideas out of them. Sometimes they pick them up, sometimes they don't. I don't know. We'll come up with some fancy name for it.
Yeah, we'll figure it out.
Yeah,
we'll send it to them.
Not infringing anyone else's trademarks.
Yeah,
but we'll have those videos soon. Mm-hmm. But in the meantime, Snagger Tool is definitely the main the claim to fame. I was using it on deployment the last couple weeks for coupling and uncoupling because constantly we were running like hard sections, so it needs an extra little crank to get that to be able to get that suction
so, seal.
Yeah. yeah, so it's like I give it the extra crank with the Snagger. Whoever I was with, they're like, oh, you really love that thing. I'm like, yeah, I do. Because
yeah.
it's handy. It's like I carry it in my chest rig and it's pulled out one yeah. tool. I don't have to like start digging for other things.
Yeah.
Right? Mm-hmm. So Snagger, the spanner wrenches, pocket organizers. Just a myriad of things. Go on our website, Modus. Is it Modus.com or .ca? I can't remember. Anyways, go to Modus. I don't think Modus is a very common name. I think if you type in Modus anywhere, that's what's going to come up.
Yeah.
DTFF5 will give you 5% off.
That's right. Stop the bleed.
If you're bleeding, stop it. Bleeding control, three methods are a tourniquet, wound packing, and direct pressure. Probably in the other order that I just said. So try to do direct pressure first. If you're going to use a tourniquet, use a good one. So don't go on Wish.
Yeah.
Because you'll wish you had another one. Or you're going to wish you're going to have 10 of them.
Yeah.
So stopthebleed.org, stopthebleed.com. Basically, anywhere you see the Stop the Bleed logo, you can go get training or you can become an instructor and teach it. Mm-hmm. It's a great course. It's a great entry-level course. You can do. You can layer it, too. You can be.
Yeah.
You can teach little kids. I wouldn't show them the videos we show them.
No.
Like, Todd and I have showed them videos we've showed them, and we've had a couple kids who leave the room. And
teaching life skills. Cool.
One threw up in the other room. Yeah, I mean, and there's lots of videos. There's a video of us on YouTube. Actually, a few videos of us showing different options on it. Some of the different skills we teach, and also the full
course. The wound packing as well. Yeah.
Yeah. So check it out. Stopbleed.org.com.
Mm-hmm. On that as well, if there's anybody listening from BC Ambulance Service that has to deal with our fucking kits and standardization, for the love of Christ, put some more goddamn tourniquets in our shit. Every jump kit and every time we get an ambulance back from standardization has one fucking tourniquet in it. It drives me nuts. So carry more than one.
Yeah, one is not enough.
That's my rant. No, Jesus Christ.
You get four limbs.
Yes. Yeah.
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 And usually, I think in the leg limbs, or the leg injuries, it's usually two.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I guarantee you check any of the ambulances that I work in, there's more than
one. Bolster.
Yeah. There is. Yeah, exactly.
And then they steal them. Why is there all these tourniquets in there?
Yeah, let's go spread those. You know, go and spread those out.
It's funny because I listen to a lot of the podcasts with the Special Forces guys, and a lot of them got injured in the war, and blown up. And there's no, the question always is, how many tourniquets do you have on you? He's like, I like 10
yeah.
on me alone.
Yeah.
Like, in my, you know, over me and on my backpack. It's like, yeah.
Yeah.
That's what you need.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
I think an ambulance should have at least 10.
Yeah. Two is enough. Anyways, that's my rant. Let's move on to...
Sorry, you think every paramedic should wear one on their belt like a police do? Like, law enforcement, we all wear it.
Just wear
it
on our belts. Yeah. Well, in theory,
I carry technically more tourniquets on.
We should be having our kit with us.
Yeah. I carry more tourniquets on me than you do in your whole ambulance. I got one on my vest, one on my belt. I know. And then, like, in my backup, like, little crappy one tucked away if yeah. I needed a third.
Yeah. No, yeah, absolutely, yeah. Pack like your life depends on it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Coffee, Wolf Tree coffee.
Yeah, Wolf Tree. We're rocking the shirts.
One day, I wear the DTFF shirt.
Yeah.
Wolf Tree coffee.
Yeah, so they've got shirts for their merch now. Really cool design that they're rocking there. I was actually over at the roastery there yesterday, chatting about it, and a big thank you to all of our listeners. The initial attack blend is rocking.
Nice.
Yeah. Like, we weren't quite sure how it was going to land, like, on the backside of seminar and everything else. They're like, it is rocking. So big, big thanks to everybody that have been putting in orders. They are shipping. And you know what? They're very, very happy with the nice. Support. But yeah, so they have a ton of coffee options. Like I was just saying, they do have our initial attack blend. It's that medium dark roast. Great, great, great flavor. Mm-hmm. With that, a $2 donation from every pound of coffee sold is donated to the Honor House Society, yeah. which is really cool. They're about to do another donation check to Honor House because they kind of let it roll up and keep tabs on it. And yeah, there's another $100 donation going into Honor House Society. So yeah, really, really awesome. Check them out on social media, Wolf Tree Coffee, and then wolftreecoffee.com. It gets you to their website where you can buy online. They will ship it to you. I think, don't quote me, but there is a minimum purchase value for online shipping or pickup or delivery in the Okanagan Valley, mm-hmm. which is where we are. So yeah.
Awesome. Tanner Olson.
Yeah, Dan Olson, he's playing everywhere right now. He's all over the place. A lot of summertime shows. Just dropped a new song, which again, I forgot what it was called. Mm-hmm. I've been listening to it today, too.
Missing Your Love?
Missing Your Love.
Oh,
hey, damn. Not something about love.
Yeah, something about love.
Yeah, Missing Your Love. Yeah, a little kind of modernized country song.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think if you rewind these podcasts years ago, I would say I hate country music. But I like Tanner.
Hey.
Holy yeah. shit.
Now, I'm announcing it, not you. So now, I actually have a country playlist on my Spotify. Ooh. Listening to it all day with the wife, because she likes country. And what I do today, bought country boots.
You bought Calvin's
country yeah. boots. What? Whatever they're called. Calvin boots. That's
the old country boots. Going to get you in a hat next.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I looked at those and like,
dang, start with a camping hat.
I got a boonie hat.
Yeah, exactly. Nah, it's not the same.
Anyways, got some of the old country boots. The old cowboy boots. I got some cowboy boots.
Awesome. And, of course, you have us, but on us, our shirts, our DTFF Moose shirt Scott is wearing. You can go on to our Facebook site there as well and see it. There's a link. It is just DTFF Store. .com will take you to it. Mm-hmm. And yeah, let us know how you guys like it. And yeah, please send in your orders. We got a bunch of them. We'll ship them out to you guys. We're shipping everywhere now.
Mm-hmm.
We should actually make some sort of little competition. We still have a handful of snaggers for giveaways. We should set up a giveaway with like a shirt, like a certain amount of shirts purchased or something. You get a snagger. Buy 10 shirts, get a snagger.
Sure.
Sure.
It's like a Todd thing. Yeah. Set that up, Todd.
Perfect.
We'll talk about it.
Yeah, come up with something for sure, though.
Give away a free car.
What? A brand new car. Tanner Olson Band, actually, just signed to Top Down.
Hey,
awesome. Yeah, so they're working with Top Down Entertainment now. Up and coming rising country star, it says. So.
Absolutely.
Yeah, pretty exciting news.
Yeah, no, they put on one hell of a show.
Yeah.
Awesome. Then you have us. So our Facebooks, our YouTube, TikTok, Instagram, those are kind of the big ones.
Yeah.
To find us on. Give us a like, give us a follow, subscribe, Spotify. Find us if you're not already listening. Tell a friend.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Any more?
I'm good.
I'm great.
Thank you. Good night.
Thank you.
Thanks. Good night.
All right. Thanks for listening, everybody. As always, stay safe. Stay DTFF.